This program provides a forum for women to speak out on issues which concern them. Listeners will have an opportunity to participate in the program by calling the KENU open line at 864-4530. Now, here is the moderator for A Feminist Perspective, KU Dean of Women, Emily Taylor.
Good evening, and welcome to A Feminist Perspective. I'm Emily Taylor, Dean of Women at KU, and the moderator of this weekly series of programs. A Feminist Perspective is sponsored by the Women's Resource and Career Planning Center, located in the Dean of Women's office, 222 Strong Hall. Our office number is 864-3552. We hope that through this program, you will become familiar with some of the many resources available to you through our office. We are concerned with anything that concerns women and have gathered people and materials to help you with questions ranging from career planning and counseling to legal rights and current legislation to medical services for women. I hope that you will call or come by soon so that we can find out what's on your mind and what kind of services you need. The goal of this program is to provide a forum for women themselves to speak publicly on issues of concern to them and help inform other women and men of the movement which is remaking the shape and substance of women's and men's lives throughout the world. The topic for discussion tonight is sex discrimination in American colleges and universities. Does it exist? This is the beginning of a four-part series. Next week, our guest panelists are going to talk on sex discrimination again, laws, court actions, and executive orders affecting higher education. 2 weeks from now, our topic will be sex discrimination at the University of Kansas. And the final program of this in this series is Affirmative Action Plans to End Discrimination at the University of Kansas. We plan to bring to you for the next three programs the women who have been most actively involved in research and in doing what they can to end discrimination. So our topic tonight is a general one that we sometimes are surprised at how often it's necessary to discuss it. And that's a question of, does discrimination actually exist in American colleges and universities? Our two guest panelists are Dr. Carol Smith and Jean Robinson, both of whom are university people. Carol Smith has joined our staff in the Dean of Women's office beginning in July. Jean Robinson is teaching at the University of Missouri at Kansas City. So they both are career people, and there's some other interesting things we might say about you folks, but I guess you could say them for yourselves. What are you trying to combine, Carol, in your life?
I am a working mother, a working wife, and a very interested professional in the area of college administration, specifically student personnel work.
And how about you, Jean? What's your lifestyle?
Well, I am a working graduate student since I'm still pursuing coursework in French here at the University of Kansas, and a working wife. I'm able to combine two loves of mine, which are French and classroom teaching, into a pleasant career that is just beginning, I think, for my life.
Mm-hmm. You know, The topic that we're beginning to discuss this month is one that Alan Pfeiffer, who is the president of the Carnegie Corporation, in a recent speech that he gave, said it was so charged with emotion these days that he's surprised that anyone has the temerity to tackle it, or that every time people attempt to tackle it, that they end up by offending everyone and pleasing no one. So I hope that that won't be what we get ourselves into tonight. Very clearly, higher education is very much on the defensive about this matter now. I think we could say, though, that no responsible person is denying that discrimination exists. At least that's what I'd say. Would you folks agree that there's not a denial of the fact of discrimination?
I would say when the subject is discussed in very broad terms, there's not a denial of discrimination. And when the question becomes very specific, talking about our department or our division or our university, we hear very many denials, daily denials.
I think that people get very defensive because they don't choose to accept the fact that, their institution or their department, as the case may be, might possibly have overlooked something that could have been both beneficial to them and more fair to the parties that were qualified for the position or the situation, as students might be the case. It gets people very excited, it gets people very bothered, and that's too bad. But at the same time, it's one of the things that, as Jean said, in generalities it's all right to talk about it, but let's not get too close to me. You know, don't say that my department's involved.
And statistics can't be denied, but if it becomes a question of questioning good faith in changing those statistics, then again the conversation changes quite radically, I think.
And I'm sure that you run into, as I do, people who think that this is just a movement by a group of radicals and that it'll go away again.
Oh, I think this is so unfortunate because I think that it makes many women who otherwise would want to step forward and have their say and to become involved be very hesitant. And this has been the history that we've gone through in the past few years. Many capable, talented, and women who've been discriminated against have been very hesitant to make this well known or to take a stand, because they actually have reason to fear, and in some cases it's been documented that it's a justified reason. They have reason to fear that their job might be on the line if they take a stand. They also, unfortunately, in some cases feel that the whole women's movement is just centered around the people and the issues that reach the front page so many times.
Is it going to go away?
Oh, I hope not. I certainly don't think so.
You can't give any specific evidence that makes you feel that, other than the fact that obviously you are concerned with equality of opportunity for all people.
One thing that makes me think it is not going to go away is that I see an increasing awareness of discrimination that isn't far removed from the individual who's just become aware of it. But if we talk about statistics once again, that awareness includes the realization that things aren't getting better as fast as people keep telling us they are. And so that argument that it'll go away because all the inequities will be corrected within the next few years just doesn't seem to be true.
Well, I think we have some indication that at least the government is now in agreeance. You know, we now have the laws and the resources within the government to enforce the laws that have been on the books for some time.
And so in effect, that phase may go away,
yes.
The phase of really needing to pressure the representatives in the government to make things clearly legal or illegal.
And some of the laws haven't been on the books very long. In fact, universities, of course, were operating pretty largely through an executive order up until this spring. But all kinds of things happened then, and of course now in every education bill there is a prohibition against sex discrimination. So.
And we still have some problems within higher education in terms of the classified personnel, so many of the classified personnel and the people, women and men, working in jobs that are not of high rank are still not necessarily covered by some of the legislation.
Mm-hmm. Or some of the legislation is in conflict with state legislation, civil service regulations or practices. And these things, of course, are all going to have to be resolved. The other reason it's most unlikely that the subject of equality is going to go away is that it's part of a much larger movement toward equality of opportunity for all kinds of people. So we have a great many potent forces, both moral and political forces, that are working in favor of it. But we do have continuously to prove again and again the fact of the existence of a problem to those who really haven't given thought to it, or who have been quite sure that they themselves are not involved in any conscious, at least, discrimination. So we might start with just some basic facts. Let's talk a little bit about what happens, relatively speaking, to boys and girls at the time they complete high school. Do you know, are there about the same number of boys and girls graduating from high school?
There is already a higher percentage of boys at that first big diploma, isn't that true? Even though the numbers are quite close, more boys graduate from high school than girls, but the big separation comes at the next important diploma, the bachelor's degree.
What happens there?
It's whether the choice of whether or not to pursue a bachelor's degree that seems to be the big dividing point. Are we told that a very high percentage of boys decide to go to school with the exact purpose of pursuing a bachelor's degree, something 80-90%. That's incorrect. I don't mean a bachelor's degree for 80-90% of the high school graduates, but something that falls under the heading of a higher education, post-high school education. But it's true that only half of the girls who graduate from high school feel they need some additional training, education, that will prepare them for the job market.
And I think that's correct, that this is for all levels of post-high school education. The 50% or the 80-90%, this will include all levels, vocational training, junior colleges, and so on.
So we're not talking about a four-year decision, the need for some program that is defined beyond high school.
There seems to be a very definite tendency on the part of women to stop at what they consider some logical point, and apparently the logical point to a great many women who could profit from post-high school training has been the high school diploma. I think we're about equal now on the numbers of men and women graduating from high school, but certainly not equal in terms of the numbers that go on. You have any theories as to why this happens? A large share of the well-qualified students who do not go on to any kind of post-high school work are girls?
I'm afraid it falls into some sort of a big category called societal expectations. And quite frankly, society and the individual students involved and their career counselors, guidance counselors at the secondary school level, and their parents and their ministers and all these people, they don't have a realistic picture of what life is going to be for this young woman in the next 50 years or the next 55 years after she's 18 or whatever age she graduate now. And a friend of ours, Dean Taylor, Dr. Kate Hebner Miller, has been trying to tell people about the real situation and the facts for 25 years, and really a lot of the statistics haven't changed that much.
Okay.
And people haven't believed her all the time.
But more and more people began to notice that the gap was getting wider and wider. We had a larger percentage of women in college, even in the 30s, than we have right now. You know, in the 30s, 47% of the college students were women, and now it's down considerably, down into the 30s somewhere. And we began to notice a lot of other gaps too, a widening gap in the salaries and occupational classifications. So it was inevitable that sooner or later it was going to come to the attention of enough people, although I know that Mrs. Miller must have felt like a voice crying in the wilderness as she attempted to explain this to people on the way. We saw increasing numbers of women going into the labor market. There's no shortage there, is there? It's become the lifestyle of about half of the population. So the question of who goes on to post-high school work helps to determine what kind of occupation they're going to be able to go into. Now, what happens beyond the bachelor's degree? Of those women who start to college, is there any difference in the percentages who are graduated? Do they tend to drop out more along the way?
Don't we find there's more of a tendency for the girls to finish the degree once they have begun the process than for the boys that begin as freshmen?
The biggest drop-out period for college women is after the first year. But if they stay beyond that, very, very high percentage will then finish the bachelor's degree.
So that when you look at the overall statistics, if the girl wants to start, she has as much chance of being graduated as the young man has. Then what about the next two steps, or really three steps? We've got the graduate education, the master's degree, and the doctorate. And we also have professional education leading to professional degrees in dentistry, law, medicine, and the rest. What happens to them there?
Well, the pattern seems to have been set by this time. At any logical stopping point, any awarding of a degree, more women seem to decide that it is now desirable for them to stop, not to pursue the follow-up degree. So the gap widens after the bachelor's degree, widens still more after the master's degree or professional degree, and at the PhD level we see the biggest difference of all.
Mm-hmm. You know what the percentage is now on the doctorate? There seems to be a slight improvement, almost 12% now. In fact, I have seen some figures as high as 13%. This compared with some 28% in the 30s, who 28% of the doctor's degrees went to women, and it fell as low as well below 10% during one period. And then, of course, we see I'm sure that the new interest and the new awareness has increased slightly the percentage of women who are completing a doctor's degree. And of course, I think everybody now knows the figures on non-lawyers and doctors. They're almost unchanging. You know, 1% of the engineers, 3.5% of the lawyers, 2% of the dentists, 7% of the physicians. The figures that hardly change at all.
That, I think, would surprise a lot of women, don't you think? There's been a lot of coverage in the newspapers within the past 2 years about pressure on medical schools or law schools to open their doors to women, and I have the feeling that some of us think that there are a lot of women who should be completing professional degrees about now, but no, there really is not a dramatic change in enrollments right now, is there?
Enrollments, I believe, may be up, especially in law. But
are we talking about 15% or 50%? Do you have any idea?
I don't believe it's near 50%, no. Mm-hmm. And also, we're talking about the people who have just started.
Yes.
They will be in another 2 years before they could possibly be practicing. The big numbers.
For example, in the field of medicine, we had National Health Act that went into effect for this class, and so we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of women admitted to the freshman classes of medical schools this year. At least we're told that that's what's happened. We have not yet seen those figures. And certainly there's tremendous new interest in law.
Although there was something I was reading recently was stressing though that as at least the people coming into law school indicate the interest of what they would like to practice, they're not talking about tax or corporate law, the women. They're talking about the kind of law that would be useful to them in societal work and societal interests. And so it may be a while before they are able to make an impact in some of these other areas, mm-hmm. if indeed it's as clear-cut as this one article said that it was so.
Because I think that's true of a lot of men now, too, who are entering law school. And I don't know what will happen in terms of percentages, and maybe it isn't very important. But one of the ways in which professional schools have reacted to new legal requirements is simply to increase the size of their freshman class. So you still have, you still could take a fair share of the women applicants, because remember they've got to want to apply. And certainly we're a far cry from any 50% because of all the societal pressures not even to apply in the first place. You'd have to start much farther back, in other words, would you not, in order to be sure that you were going to have a sufficient amount of interest on the part of women, even if there was no attempt at discrimination at all in the selection of students for any of the professional schools. Now, what about in the teaching field in higher education? We're sometimes told that since around 20%, somewhere between 20 and 22% of college faculties are women, that this is an evidence that there isn't any discrimination against the hiring of women in faculty positions. Can you think of any reasons that those figures may not tell the whole story? Does it make any difference what kind of school, for instance, we're talking about?
Yes, that and also what level of faculty position we're talking about. Because in all cases, if you start looking at the total picture, you must break it down in terms of the numbers of professors, associate professors, assistant professors, and other teaching staff. And that's the order in which women are not going. The numbers of full professors are just infinitesimal compared to the numbers of assistant professors and other teaching staff positions that are filled by women.
And I don't know that we have figures on even at the rank where most PhDs enter the department, the assistant professor. I don't know that we have figures about tenured and non-tenured positions, but I guess this is one other indication that the women do not have secure positions within major universities, that there are many untenured women who perhaps are not considered as potentially permanent members of that faculty by their university.
Then also to get up to the 20%, you combine the 5 to 8% in the universities with 35 or 40% in junior colleges and in teachers' colleges in all kinds of schools other than universities. In fact, one recent study at one of the prestige universities indicated 1% of the full professors down to 5% of the assistant professors, the entry level for PhDs in most cases. And it doesn't take, you have to divide those into types of colleges before you get any kind of an accurate picture of what's going on. And of course, there is a question then of what advancement they get after they enter after they get the job in the first place. What about how do people get jobs and teaching jobs in colleges?
That's a large hazy zone, and that's exactly the problem that women have to find out how men get jobs and how women do or do not get jobs and know the system or make some effort to change that system. I think that it's widely accepted that many people get jobs because they hear about an opening from a friend or from an advisor, and lots of people are just writing letters of inquiry about jobs because they have to assume that the opening may not be advertised. And this is a highly debatable way to recruit, but it seems to be the regular practice at most universities and colleges alike.
And this isn't something that's just happened overnight. It's been like this for, you know, a long, long time, that it's word of mouth. Who you know and who can recommend you. And the thing that concerns us most about potential women faculty is the factor about just not knowing that a position is available. And it isn't helped at all by the fact that we now have somewhat of a PhD surplus, especially in some areas.
And I think that there are generally fewer people in many departments involved in hiring than a lot of the prospective job applicants realize. We know that a very high percentages of departments are chaired by men, and in many, many departments, that person has the most influence in recruiting and might have a lot of control in which letters of interest, which dossier are seen by other members of that department. Or it may be a committee of, again, tenured departmental members of higher rank, and the chances of women being on those committees are much, much lower when we look at the percentages of women eligible for those committees.
Even if it was a complete cross-section of the department, in many departments there would be, there are no women at all, you still might not get any who were recommended. We were told that a great many years ago in a famous book called The Academic Marketplace, which is plainly said women aren't a part of this process, that you call up your old professor or perhaps an old student of yours who's is now in a department somewhere else and ask if he knows any good men for the job. Even if you said if he knows any good people for the job, which of course would help, you're still dependent upon who gets the call. And in every field, certainly there are people who play that kind of role. So one of the things which is being recommended now by practically all affirmative action programs is opening up this whole area of recruitment so that all people who are properly qualified will know that the job is available and can submit their credentials and applications in case they're interested.
I think that one place where it all breaks down too often, though, is when the women have found out about the opening and they have submitted letters of application and sent their credentials, perhaps, and then some myths enter into the consideration of that application, and I have heard several times the statement that a young woman was not considered for an interview because the department was looking for someone who would be there on a somewhat permanent basis or didn't want to go through this recruiting process again in a year or two, so they looked at the men's applications more seriously. And we have again seen studies that show that is a myth, that women change jobs more often, are going to follow their husband to another job whenever a better job turns up for him. But that's a very actively accepted myth.
Another one of the myths along the same line is that women haven't produced. This is in terms of the publish or perish expectations for faculty members. And that just isn't true.
We'll have pause for a moment for station identification. During this half of our program, we would welcome the use of our open line. It's 864-4530. If anyone would care to call with questions or comments. 864-4530. Well, we've talked a little bit about some of the reasons behind the decline of women in higher education. There are lots of other theories that we haven't mentioned at all. I'm just going to mention a couple of them myself, and if others occur to you, don't hesitate to interrupt me. Some, of course, were economic. both in terms of since this process started during the Depression, there was a strong feeling that if there wasn't enough to go around, it ought to go to men. So that preference in hiring was certainly given to men at that time. We also had, at that time, you recall, a very low birth rate, so that women were probably better able then than they are right now, or at least than they were in the 40s and 50s when we had a tremendous increase in the birth rate with the back to the home movement following the Second World War. Now, of course, we have a new movement away again from the large families brought on by recognition of overpopulation. So we have a lot of interrelated sets of circumstances. Also, even in terms of the percentages of women, we had a tremendous influx of men after the war, very naturally, and men who had to put off their education in order to serve in the armed forces, thereby forcing down the percentage of women in a perfectly natural way, in addition to the fact that if the family couldn't afford to send both the man and the woman, the tendency was to send the man. But in the aggregate, all of the theories that have been advanced, or none of the theories that have been advanced, and no combination of them really is totally satisfactory in terms of even explaining what happened, let alone what's right to do about it now that people are well aware of what's happened. So let's talk about some of the other evidences we have of actual discrimination. Whether it's when we talk about discrimination, we're not necessarily saying that it's conscious. In lots of cases it is, and in lots of other cases it's not a conscious process at all, but just the acceptance of certain kinds of things, some of the myths that you've referred to, and some other kinds of societal attitudes that don't necessarily represent sexism on the part of any individual about, you'd have to know the individual, in other words, before you'd know. You can't say all men or all women or even certain kinds of men and women. What about the salary situation? Is that equitable?
Not at all, but that's an area that a lot of women just don't know about. It seems to me that this is something that's going to take longer to correct in the university situation than it does for people who are, for instance, under a union contract. If you're negotiating a contract and it's everyone's salary is right in front of you, well then certainly you can talk about whether someone is being discriminated against because of race or sex or whatever the criteria might be. But in the university situation, we tend not to know anyone else's salary. It's so difficult to compare performance and credentials, and it all becomes the judgment of someone else. Perhaps we don't want to challenge their judgment, and I think a lot of women are very definitely paid less at every single rank in universities across the country. A lot of those women now know that, and maybe they didn't a few years ago.
And those figures, at least on a national basis, are available to everyone. All one would need to do would be to take the census figures on the characteristics of the population, or all the many educational statistics that come out of the Office of Education and the Health, Education, and Welfare to find that out, that as groups, they certainly are not paid equitable salaries.
And for a particular institution that is a public institution, the budget is a matter of public record.
In public institutions, yes.
That's in public institutions. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But I have discovered that the colleges and universities are certainly not making any effort to make sure that all the employees know the facts or the salaries of other people in similar ranks or qualifications. I discovered you have to do quite a bit of library searching in my particular university to find out things like that that are public record.
In other words, not everything which is public record is public knowledge.
Right.
Right. But they, at the University of Kansas, these figures are available in the library, I understand, so that there can't be any question there. And actually the Public Information Acts are such that this information couldn't really be withheld. But you've pointed out some other things which may look like sex discrimination but not be provable as such. Such things, for instance, as a rank that a person holds or how he or she is judged by other people. In
many cases, it's those people who have a higher rank who make the decision about promotion for people of lower rank. Well, if all the people of higher rank happen to be men who aren't aware of looking at women colleagues differently than they look at their male colleagues, perhaps that's a very difficult area to increase their awareness of their own judgments.
Another factor that enters in here into the salary and promotional considerations is the very serious lack of stability that many women have had in the faculty ranks for years because they've been maintained on temporary or part-time positions or always being hired, as they say, by need. And then you aren't able to gain an advanced rank when you're always being hired what ends up being full-time, that you're teaching full-time, but you're only a temporary instructor or a temporary assistant professor or visiting or acting.
Mm-hmm. Which means no fringe benefits and no opportunity for tenure.
And the role of the deans can't be ignored in the area of promotion too. Certainly departments are aware of influence and they know that their departmental recommendations can be vetoed by the dean in their particular school. So if the attitudes are unknown or if any plan of affirmative action seems to be unknown within the administration of that school, that might affect decisions in the departments.
Well, you see various examples of very sad things in this area. For instance, one of the very prestigious universities in the East, Columbia, has made a real effort in the past several years to get more women involved in their doctoral programs. And for last year, they gave 25% of their doctorates awarded to women. Well, that's just outstanding since the national average is around 12. But at the same time, during the past few years, while they've been placing this emphasis on female doctoral students, they haven't increased the number of women on their own faculty. And so you don't know what to think about that.
We would hope that they would be concerned about their own graduates finding jobs somewhere else, but I wonder if any of them are forced to prove themselves in a less prestigious college.
Maybe they believe in what's really purely folklore, that women with doctor's degrees only work until they marry or until they have children. We still hear that occasionally, don't we? You know of any research to the contrary?
Well, I think it's been proven that actually a higher percentage of women who have earned PhDs remain in university jobs for their entire professional life than men. And again, that's a complex situation. Maybe the men have more offers outside the university community, but that shouldn't be a concern for the universities that are hiring.
There was a study that was done 8 years after doctors were received, and 4/5 of the women were still in the workforce in the university setting. And I forget the percentage who had not taken any time away from their professional career.
It was a very large percentage.
Yes.
Even though they had married and had children.
Had children.
Hadn't even, 79% hadn't interrupted their careers at all, despite other facts in their personal lives.
I think women are very hesitant to ask for a leave of absence for any reasons that have to do with having a family or wanting to drop out of the job for a year for whatever reasons there might be, because she is so aware of her precarious situation on that faculty and is not going to risk a job by asking something that may be very reasonable, but is not customary.
It's also not very surprising that only about 30% had changed jobs one time. I'm surprised, and that's about the same as it is for men. I'm surprised that that figure is not even higher, because men get more offers, mm-hmm. and so one would assume that that an even higher proportion of men would leave. But actually, the rates are very similar. So that women with doctorates are in the labor force in just as large a proportion, if not a larger proportion, than men are. When they take jobs, they do remain just as long. They do not change more often. They are not more mobile. Anyone hiring them would have just as good a chance of their remaining as they would a young man remaining that they hired.
And they have made at least equal, if not more than equal, professional contributions through
That's right.
publications mm-hmm. and organizations.
That's another thing which gets very much misunderstood. You cannot compare the most productive male scholars with women faculty members in general, since many of them, as you've pointed out, are employed in schools where publications and research are there's not very much pressure for them and not very much opportunity for them. So you would have to compare the productivity of men and women in the same kind of setting. And those comparisons have indicated that there's no difference in the amount of productivity for those who consider that that's a terribly important aspect of college teaching. What have been the results of nepotism rules or similar kinds of institutional arrangements? They aren't all really nepotism rules.
Well, they certainly have been reevaluated within the past 15 years, so that now that is one area where there's been a lot of improvement made. But in many cases, it comes back to being the prerogative of the department chairman. Or since it is indeed true that people in like areas or with like interests do tend to marry one another, why this often becomes a problem, and institutions have resolved it in a number of different ways.
I have here a study which was run by the American Association of University Women that concludes from the universities and colleges responding to their questioning, 35% of the schools replying still do not hire members of the same family, and this is usually interpreted or enforced when we're talking about hiring in the same department, but not necessarily so. And it says such nepotism policies are particularly evident at public institutions of over 10,000 students and least evident at private and women's colleges and small campuses, which kind of surprised me. I had thought that when the university was larger, the department was larger, there'd be less concern about two members of the same family. Once again, I think when we talk about the most prestigious universities across the nation, they will fit into this group, over 10,000 public institutions.
So the situation is by no means
completely resolved. Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of these schools also are the kind, the situation we have here in Lawrence, where there is only one university in this town. So if this school of over 10,000 students enforces that ruling, there really isn't another university where the spouse can work without commuting.
Situation here is no regulation against it, except in the same department. And I think those are departmental rather than one cannot supervise the other. Which is reasonable, I presume, except that it sounds like a true old-fashioned hierarchy where, you know, everybody's responsible to somebody else, and not a very democratic process of determining, who should be advanced and who shouldn't, or not even a very honest process where people can honestly do their best to evaluate without worrying about personal relationships?
In a major university in the Midwest, a Big Ten school, a vice president for academic affairs was quoted as saying, if a husband and wife have always worked as a research team, of course we'd expect them to continue to work together. Now that's pretty unusual. But if they're in the same department but in very different areas, that's all right too. But if they're in the same area, we'd try to put one in a department and one in an institute. If there's no way around it and both are needed, then they might be hired in the same area. That was not this institution.
I would say he's more advanced than most than most colleges have gotten, or most universities have gotten in this respect. Another thing that we often that often appears in affirmative action programs, and these give an indication. Of course, there's no point in asking for some change to be made if there's nothing which needs to be changed. So one gets a pretty good idea of what things are like by looking at the kinds of affirmative actions that are either proposed by governmental agencies or by affirmative action groups within universities. And one of them always deals with fringe benefits. So why, in your opinion, is that important, or is it important?
I don't know if the area, if we can want to talk about part-time employees at this point, but that is a classic example of a large group of people who are working and who are generally excluded from fringe benefits, whether that mean medical care programs or retirement benefits, tenure, any kind of guarantee of employment. It just happens, or perhaps it doesn't just happen, but it seems that a high percentage of part-time teachers at colleges and universities who are not also students are women. So these women may have been working in this university for 10 or 20 or more semesters and have no more salary or job security or benefits than they had the first time they became a part-time employee.
Yes, a president of one of our large Midwestern universities told me last spring, or I guess it was this summer, that a department in his school had a woman who was with a great many publications and a very fine reputation as a teacher, who had the title acting in front of her associate professorship for about 12 years, I believe it was. And he had that year told them they would have to decide whether they were going to keep her on a permanent basis or continue. Why do you think women submit to that sort of thing?
It seems that there are always many people who would like to work half-time, many more people who would like to work part-time than there are openings. And if the feeling, I believe, is if you're offered a job, we'll say at the University of Kansas, to work half-time, and you say, I'll accept if you will incorporate some kinds of fringe benefits, even job security that perhaps is more than a semester-long contract, well then the institution has always been very able to say, no thank you, we have three other people waiting for this job who aren't making any demands. I think the part-time employees almost never get to know each other. I might be teaching at strange hours and have no group
I think that's a key point, that people haven't known that there was something that they could do, that they haven't known that it was a more widely spread problem than just their own, or just their own and one friend, you know.
Which has certainly been one of the advantages of the awareness processes of the publication of facts and figures and of people talking about it, has resulted in a good many of these women who didn't know that there was anything they could do about it taking action against the universities or against the department or making demands, since it's also built into the law, of course, that there cannot be recrimination, so that if there is, then the woman has an opportunity to prove that through the enforcement agencies. Just received a word the other day about a woman who had been given she'd been given a permanent position back salary for all that she had missed from the time that she should have received this position, so that the college is now in the process of attempting to negotiate with her because they owe her some about $50,000 as a result of proven discrimination, for the same reason that we're talking about right now. I mean, that you've just been talking about, of the fact that she was kept in a temporary status and refused tenure on the grounds that she was married to somebody who was also at the university, and this was the university's method of making use of her services without actually paying her what she deserved. Go ahead.
I was just going to say there's a problem on the part of the university. Part-time jobs in teaching are almost never really half of a beginning salary. They're very underpaid. The department sometimes feels badly about this, but doesn't have any way to pay a higher scale, and so kind of rationalizes that by not requiring any kind of participation in departmental meetings or decision-making processes, that's lessening the job of the part-time employee. Well, really, that perpetuates the alienation and the real lack of any ability to have any input in changing it.
That's the old saw that the universities with graduate schools have used so long about, we're paying you with the privilege of going to school here, you know? And it may be a wonderful, warm thought, but it really doesn't help you a lot with your either your ego or your food.
And then at certain periods, because of the societal conditions, the shortage of household help, the shortage of child care facilities, there are many women who would like to work on a part-time basis. And another item that we often find in affirmative action programs is the requirement that they be able to move freely from one status to another, but that the fringe benefits on a prorated basis should go along with the part-time as well as full-time employment. So far, the government has acted only in a coercive way to try to force colleges to do what they should have done anyway. There is also the hope, however, on the part of a lot of people that that the federal government should play a more active, positive role in providing grants and financial assistance to colleges and universities to correct inequities, since there's with the great shortage of money. There's no doubt that most colleges and universities would have a great deal of difficulty in actually correcting all the inequities that exist for them.
Do you have any idea on a local level whether there is this flexibility of can a person go from a full-time faculty appointment to a part-time appointment without jeopardizing his rank and his job? I'm talking about a non-tenured person.
I don't know that there's anything which is written out about that, but this is in subsequent programs as we deal specifically with the University of Kansas. This is a question that you should make a note to call in and ask one of the authorities that we will have here for that program. Well, in the few minutes that are left, are there other specific items in the general area of sex discrimination in colleges and universities? Does it exist that you think we should touch upon?
Well, there's a whole area about student admission that is of great concern to people who are in the know and who care about the feminist movement. Many universities across the United States have not admitted women on equal par or based on the same criteria that they've applied to men. And there are a lot of things that are being done now at this time and within the past few years to try to make it a more equitable situation. And the students in high school will be overjoyed to hear this.
We often read that in a public school such as KU that is required to take everyone, that this solves the problem. Of course, it doesn't even touch the problem of graduate school or of professional schools.
Or out-of-state applications.
Or out-of-state applications. It deals only with an open policy for freshmen who have never gone anywhere else to school. Because once they've gone to school somewhere else, then they become transfer students and can be accepted or rejected on the basis of their transcript.
Another group we haven't had time to discuss, we could certainly wonder about the absence of women on boards of regents or trustees, whatever the institution may call its ultimate governing body. And it seems that in half of the institutions polled, there are no women or there's only one woman. And certainly that's not anywhere in keeping with percentages of women students or faculty members or residents.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is another place that the faculty and the administrative staff get hurt, because indeed these are the people who are having a lot of influence on the policies and the dealings, the day-to-day dealings of the administration of the university, faculty, for both faculty and staff, as well as students.
Because the same thing might be said of all kinds of decision-making groups within the university that
heavily
are poorly represented, and should be, of course, on all of those. There's a question, of course, of financial aids, of scholarships, of fellowships, and lots of evidence on an overall basis. I'm not speaking here of KU, with whom we deal later, but on an overall basis throughout the country of heavy accent on financial aids to men beyond what's given to women.
As well as grants to faculty members to want to relieve the teaching load and add to the...
Mm-hmm. In this area, there's been so much talk recently about the athletic scholarships and how much money that puts just directly into grants that are available only to men.
Mm-hmm. With the people working on affirmative action suggesting that the fair thing then would be to make sure that those are matched, not necessarily in athletics, but matched in a dollar to dollar, dollar for dollar, with scholarships especially for women. Our time is up. We appreciate you joining us tonight, and I thank you, Jean and Carol, for your participation. We hope that you will join us again next Monday as we discuss the specific laws, court actions, and executive orders dealing with the subject of sex discrimination in higher education. Good evening.